Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Chuck Hammond broadcasting live from the global headquarters of the 401k Study Group. The show is Content That Moves the Needle. Today is December 16th, 2015, and we are going to talk today with Mr. Thomas Clark of the Wagner Law Firm. Tom is a very well-respected ERISA attorney, been traveling around the country talking to me about what's been going on and what we're going to see in the next wave of ERISA litigation. So, Tom, welcome to the show again. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, other than the fact that we're going to be talking about how busy every single ERISA attorney seems to be in this country right now, the big day is Saturday, Star Wars. Are you going?
I'm actually going tomorrow night, Thursday. I have my 7 p.m. tickets.
Well, I will tell you that my two boys are excited. Mom, not so much, but, you know, we're going to be there. And although not as exciting, maybe, as ERISA litigation, Star Wars should be a real big deal. So I don't think I can open up my email. I don't think I can go to any sort of investment advisor type of publication without seeing a slew of litigation that's coming up right now. You've been traveling pretty much nonstop for the last 12 months, speaking about what's going on, what's coming, what to expect. So, Tom, who's being sued and why?
Yeah, it's very interesting, Chuck. The next wave of litigation is happening, and some of it has been under the radar so far. It seems that the large plan sponsors have been sued. They've been picked over. The lowest hanging fruit has been one and done. And now we're moving on to more cases related to providers. And we're seeing cases at a very high level where they're either against the provider as a provider, or they're against the provider as both a plan sponsor and a provider where they're using their own products. So just as a list of all the – just as a broad list of the different defendants that have happened just in the last few months, we've seen lawsuits filed against BB&T, Putnam, Allianz PIMCO, Great West, Prudential, New York Life, MetLife, Tia Cref, State Farm. Those aren't exactly small bit players. These are major players that are now seeing the insides of courtrooms.
So is this all coming from the same firm, or is this coming from new sources or different sources?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's definitely cases being filed by the old players. My old firm, Schlichter, Bogart & Detten, has filed one of the lawsuits against BB&T. They still have their lawsuits out there against others. But there's at least one new kid on the block, a firm called Nichols Castor out of Minnesota. They have filed three of these proprietary product-type cases in just the last month and a half, 2 months. They have not been on the scene since 2006 when all of this really started.
Tom, it's interesting to see that, you know, typically you hear of one firm, which is your former firm. Now we're starting to see some of these other firms enter the fray. And I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. Luckily, I know some folks that have a far better and deeper grasp of these things. So I've got two questions, and, you know, and you can get to them in whatever order you like. What types of claims are we going to see? And then as sort of a follow-up to that, in your opinion, although, you know, it's not legal advice, you're not speaking to anyone specifically, you know, what's important for advisors to know about what's going on right now? Because, you know, every day there's something new. It's hard to keep up on it. You know, it's your job, but as an advisor, we're not necessarily, I don't think all of us, as in tune as to what's going on in your arena as maybe either we should be, or maybe our understanding just isn't there. So what types of claims are we seeing? And maybe you can translate that into some practical application for advisors out there trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, I'll address actually your second question first very quickly and then get back to it after. answering your first, which is that, remember, each of these cases is just that. It's an accusation. It's an allegation. None of this is proven true until a judge or a jury, very rarely a jury, but until a judge says, yes, you're wrong. And even most of the time we see these cases settle, and even then, no one has actually said verbatim, you've done something wrong, you're bad, you know, here is your scarlet letter. Instead, these are allegations. And so to those advisors out there that hear the list of these providers, this doesn't necessarily mean anything's done anything wrong. What it means is that when you see these complaints and you see the particular facts that the plaintiff's firms are alleging, it means the advisor should probably be looking into it. They should have a process for addressing the kinds of things they see in these complaints if it's a provider that they're using on a regular basis. Go call up that provider. Have a conversation with them. Do your due diligence and make sure that none of the facts apply in the situation of your clients. And if they do, then maybe you should be calling someone like me, and we'll have a fuller discussion about what to do in those situations. But back to your first question, what kind of cases are we seeing? So let's start off with where we've been. We're continuing to see these proprietary type cases being filed. So what do I mean by that? It's the kind of case like we saw against Ameriprise, right? Or the case against we saw against MassMutual that's still outstanding. Allegations about using your own products. You know, these are some of the most successful cases my old firm has had. What makes these cases different than from some of the others is with here you have base claims of self-dealing, and federal courts seem to like that. Federal judges, I think, have a hard time accepting the idea that we're going to find liability against a fiduciary for simply being asleep at the switch. The non-feasance type cases, the judges just don't relate to those cases as well as they relate to cases where we're discussing malfeasance and self-dealing and that you were trying to, you know, get one over on the plan participants. And so we're seeing these continued proprietary cases being filed out of the list that I gave before. Maybe three or four or five of those cases have those types of allegations. What's very interesting about these new ones is a point I made earlier, that the lowest hanging fruit, the billion-dollar plans, have already been picked over. Now we're getting down into plan sponsors that and plans where the assets are under $1 billion, and they're between $500 million and $1 billion. And that really is an interesting thing because the damages are not as high, and therefore there's less of a reward for the firms, the plaintiff's firms, that are willing to take the risk of litigating these cases. And let me be clear about something so that no one is confused. These cases cost millions and millions and millions of dollars to litigate if done correctly and with the intention of winning. And so I know there's many of my colleagues and other people out there who have said, you know, we're going to see a parade of plaintiff's firms coming in. And yes, while we do see this new plaintiff's firm, I think it's going to be a completely different story. Only very select and limited firms are even going to get into this area because of the amount of knowledge and the money that it takes to litigate these cases. But it's still worth noting that these cases are now moving down market to the smaller of the large plan sponsors that are out there. So, again, these proprietary cases where the plan sponsors are also providers and they're using their own products. There's also been a whole new line of cases against insurance company providers over their general accounts. And the basic claim in that situation is they're arguing that because the crediting rate is because the provider can control the crediting rate and or the crediting rate isn't high enough, it means that the general account products are not, quote, guaranteed benefit products under ERISA. And so what the heck does all that mean? Well, that means if you're not a guaranteed benefit product or benefit contract or whatever the right word is under ERISA, I probably should know, it means that the assets held in the account are ERISA assets. So this is along the same line of the exception that mutual funds have. Mutual funds have a built-in exception in ERISA that makes the underlying assets of the mutual funds not ERISA assets. Therefore, the mutual fund companies have the freedom to not worry about individual transactions for individual securities. I mean, they even could buy the same security. So let's say it's in, we're dealing with GE, and GE has a mutual fund on their plan. That mutual fund company doesn't have to worry about the fact that it may have GE stock in that mutual fund, completely unrelated to the plan. Everyone would believe that's reasonable. Here, general accounts generally have the same type of exception under ERISA. However, you have to guarantee some kind of benefit, meaning a floor on these general account stable value products. And when you don't, it can get very wonky and very squishy, because now all of a sudden you're talking about these assets being ERISA assets. And that, in my opinion, is an insurance company provider's worst nightmare. There's probably very little else that we could ever have them, that they could ever be accused of in the context of an ERISA lawsuit that would cause them more angst and more heartburn. And so we've seen one of these filed a while ago, and it's working its way through the courts, and now we see three more just filed in the last few weeks. The third kind of new case we're seeing is very particularized claims against target date funds. So we haven't seen the onslaught of claims where people are just saying target date funds are inherently bad, or the to versus through argument, or anything like that. I don't think we'll see those lawsuits until the market tanks again. And then you'll see people coming out of the woodwork probably attacking target date funds for their equity composition, et cetera. Here, we've got some very particularized claims against target date funds. One involving a proprietary setup, another one involving the use of alternative investments as part of those target date funds. Again, so very interesting, particular claims. For more information on that, Chuck, I run my blog, fiduciarymattersblog.com. People can go on there and download the complaints from these cases and make up their own minds about what the allegations are. But we're seeing those cases. We'll probably see, I would bet money, that we'll see more and more cases involving target date funds as they target date fund families, as they get more and more assets, and therefore the damages can increase if there is some type of harm alleged. And you'll see those get more and more and more attention in the future. And then finally, the last big bucket of cases that haven't been filed yet, but that we're seeing advertisements for. And what I mean by that is typically the plaintiff's firms don't have people come to them and say, hey, I've got some complex problems with my 401k plan here. I don't understand this page 17 of the disclosure. That's just not something that happens. The real truth is that plaintiff's firms sometimes have somebody walk in, but other times they find the cases themselves. They find the harms in the plans based on the publicly available information. That's why in my new life on this side of the fence, I've actually been teaching people about prospecting 5500s, because I spent so much time prospecting 5500s myself when I used to be on the other side of the fence. So what we're seeing right now is more and more newspaper advertisements, which are used to find those plaintiffs. You'll see an advertisement in the newspaper, and it'll say, are you a participant in such and such a plan? Please call us. Lots of different firms use that mechanism. We're seeing more of those advertisements all of a sudden show up for ERISA 403B plans. And that is a group that has not largely been a focus of this litigation, given the inherent differences between 403B plans and 401k plans, but we may just see that in the future.
Tom, that's a tremendous amount of information. I think what usually stands out to me, especially since I've been doing this a while, is the volume. It seems to me that almost every day something new pops up, and although this isn't the next wave of ERISA litigation, I'm going to ask you, I saw something posted a couple of days ago about the automatic extension for the 5500 being stopped, and it was buried in like a highway traffic bill. Does that happen, and do I even have that close to being right?
About the fact that the extension, I think, got extended or reduced. It used to be for 3 months, and now it's for two, or something along those lines.
Well, I think more importantly for me, being an advisor, it was stuck in a transportation bill or something like that. And my point is, it's just hard for advisors to keep up on this. Thankfully, you do have a blog. thankfully you do post to Twitter, although I do think that your, you know, your travel schedule and your actual legal work has sort of put a little damper on that for the last couple of weeks, but I think you've got a ton of new fodder, so if you don't follow Tom on Twitter and you don't follow the Fiduciary Matters blog, you should. I think that, you know, I posted it to LinkedIn because I saw it, you know, another ERISA firm had posted something about it being in there, and I just thought that was really odd that something relating to a Form 5500 would be stuck in a highway transportation bill, as opposed to the big news which came out late last night or this morning about the budget bill and not being able to hold up the DOL's new definition of fiduciary.
Right. Washington never ceases to amaze me as to how they conduct business. But you're right. ERISA-type stuff is thrown in on these other laws all the time. I did see the reference to the 5500. I also was reading the tax bill that was posted at midnight last night. I was reading it at 6 o'clock this morning and emailing with my colleagues about it. And you are correct. All of the threats of the riders related to the new DOL reproposed conflict of interest rule were not in the tax bill. So for those proponents of the rule and proponents of the DOL, that is one victory. I don't believe, however, that that is the last word. I still think you'll see independent legislation. Whether the president will be inclined to sign that, which he obviously isn't since he's put so much political weight behind it. It's not the last you heard, but that was probably their single best opportunity through legislation. What did come through, however, on there was a re-proposed definition of church plan rules. And I believe, and I have to do some further analysis and really dig in, but I believe that in addition to making sure that church plan participants have access to things like automatic enrollment, et cetera, I believe that these new rules are going towards expanding the definition of church plan in certain cases, and that the rules are intended to address the lawsuits that I've been writing upon on my blog for years now about these cases that have been brought saying that church-affiliated actors like nonprofit hospitals are not church plans and therefore don't meet the definition of church plans. And there we're not talking about defined contribution plans, but actually defined benefit plans. And the goal being if you're a church plan, defined benefit plan, you don't have any funding rules. You don't have PBGC premiums. But if you're not eligible for the church plan exemption and you are subject to ERISA, then all of those things are there and those plans become a lot more expensive. There's been 10 or 11 or almost 12 of those lawsuits filed, and some of them are in front of circuit courts. A district court just sided with the church plan the other day, finding that it was eligible for the exemption. A couple of the others have settled in the last few weeks. So this legislation, I believe, is going right towards that, but I have to do further review considering it's only a couple hours old.
Well, the landscape is absolutely changing more rapidly than I thought it would. I thought the biggest thing we'd see this year would be the whole DOL fiduciary proposal, and literally on a daily basis I, you know, get some type of news bulletin and there's something new popping up. The 403B ERISA case, or the potential for that, is very, very new to me. I long thought that was a land that was forgotten, and I don't necessarily know from a legal perspective why or how any of it will turn out, but to hear that is exceptionally interesting. I'm very fortunate. I don't have a direct line to Tom Clark, but you know, I do have the privilege of making sure that I follow what he's writing. And if you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. His handle is @TomClark, _ERISA. Go to the Fiduciary Matters blog and make sure you read what he's writing. That's one thing an advisor can do. And I think, you know, for those of you who don't know Tom, he and I did a session a few months ago on, you know, when to start a relationship with an ERISA attorney. And you should listen to that as well, because you need to start a conversation both for you and for your plan sponsor clients long before you need one. And I think having access to the work that someone like Tom does when he's just putting it out there for anyone to consume, I think is a huge benefit to advisors. So, Tom, I told you that I'd only keep you for 20 minutes. It's been longer than that. Is there anything that you want to close with before I let you go?
What I would say is, on the last topic we were talking about of the reproposed rule, expect a final rule sooner rather than later. I wouldn't be surprised to see it in January, considering that the administration has to build in as much time as they can for enforcement, an enforcement holding pattern before the thing becomes final or before it becomes enforceable. So that'll be my last comment, my last little tidbit for the advisors out there. We'll get through the holidays, and I think shortly after the holidays we'll be hit upside the head with the new rule, and we'll all be reacting to that.
Well, for those of you who aren't following Tom, I can't tell you. I'm going to tell you a third time. Follow him. These are big changes. You know, we've got a new wave of ERISA litigation. We've got the potential for some folks venturing into the 403B ERISA space. We've got, you know, product-specific claims. We've got the litigation moving a tad bit downstream or down market. We've got a whole host of issues that you need to be aware of. And following Tom on Twitter, following his blog, listening to the shows when we have the privilege of having him on is a bonus and it's a benefit. So I implore you to take advantage of those. So, Tom, I want to thank you very much for being on today. As always, I appreciate your expertise and the support you give the group, and more importantly, the support you're trying to provide with scale to advisors. So thank you very much for being on, and I hope you have a great holiday.
Thank you, Chuck. Same to you.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye.
Bye.